their landscape. Especially, I'm coming to understand that culture's special regard for winter. It's the season to come through. My 84-year-old neighbor is an incredibly cheerful person by all other standards, but she will remark of a relative or friend, "Well, she's still with us after the winter." It's not just about icy sidewalks and inconvenience. She lost two sisters and a lifelong friend during recent winters. She carries in living memory a time when bitter cold and limited diets compromised everyone's immunities, and the weather forced people to hunker down and share contagions. Winter epidemics took their heartbreaking due, not discriminating especially between the old and the young. For those of us who have grown up under the modern glow of things like vaccinations, penicillin, and central heat, it's hard to retain any real sense of this. We flock indoors all the time, to work and even to exercise, sharing our germs in all seasons, but vitamins are ready at hand any time for those who care, and antibiotics mop up the fallout. Tying my family's nutritional fortunes to the seasons did not really involve any risk for us, of course, but it did acquaint us in new ways with what seasons mean and how they matter. The subtle downward pulse of temperatures and day lengths created a physical rhythm in our lives with beats and rests. Long muscles, long light, shorter days, shorter work, and cold that drew us deeper into thoughts and plans under plaster ceilings instead of an open sky. I watched the rank-and-file jars in our pantry decline from army to platoon, and finally to lonely sentries staggered along the shelves. We weren't rationing yet, but I couldn't help counting the weeks until our first spring harvests and the happy reopening day of the farmer's market. I had a vision of our neighbors saying of us, "Well, they're still with us after the winter." In late February, official end of Hungry Month, I was ready to believe we and all our animals had come through the lean times unscathed, and then one of our turkey hens took to standing around looking droopy. She let her wings drop to the ground instead of folding them on her back in normal turkey fashion. Her shoulders hunched and her head jutted forward, giving her a Nixon-esque air, minus the eyebrows and crafty agenda. This girl just looked dazed. "Oh no," I thought, "here we go. Farm animals lucky enough to live on pasture must deal with winter eventually, and health challenges similar to those faced by people in previous generations. Less fresh air, more indoor congregation and risk of contagion, and the trial of surviving on stored hay or grain instead of fresh greens and hunted protein. In the realm of contagious maladies, poultry husbandry is notoriously challenging. And turkeys are even more disease-prone than chickens. You never see it coming," a turkey-experienced friend of mine had warned when we first got our poults. "One day they're walking around looking fine, next thing you know, drop-dead Fred." The list of afflictions that can strike down a turkey would excite any hypochondriac. Blackhead roundworm, crop bind, coccidiosis, paratyphoid, pullerum disease, and many more. In one of my poultry handbooks, the turkey chapter is subtitled, "A Dickens to Raise." So far, though, my turkeys had stayed hale and hearty, and I'd taken all the doomsaying with a grain of salt. Virtually all turkey info sources in existence, including my friend with her drop-dead Freds, refer to the broad-breasted white, the standard factory farm turkey that's also the choice of most hobby farmers and 4-H projects simply because the alternatives aren't well known. My heirloom Bourbon Reds were a different bird, not bred for sluggardly indoor fattening, but for scrappy survival in the great outdoors. They retain a genetic constitution for foraging, flying, mating, and, I hoped, resisting germs. Even so, my goal of keeping these birds alive through the winter and into their second year for breeding was statistically audacious. The longer a bird is kept, the greater its chances of being overwhelmed by pathogens. The great majority of modern turkeys can expect an earthly duration of only 4 months before meeting their processor. Free-range turkeys may take as long as 6 months to reach slaughter size, but any bird that lives past its first Thanksgiving inhabits a domain occupied by fewer than 0.5% of domestic turkeys. At 9 months, my flock had now entered that elite age bracket among the oldest living turkeys in America. When I undertook to keep a naturally breeding flock, I hadn't thought much about what I was up against. Nor did I have any clue now which possible turkey ailment my poor droopy hen might have. The drear blackhead roundworm topped my worry list, since its inventory of symptoms began with droopy aspect, proceeding from there into aspects too unpleasant to mention. I immediately removed Miss Droop from the rest of the flock, assuming she'd be contagious. I've had kids in preschool, I know that much. I ushered her out of the big outdoor pen attached to the poultry house and escorted her several hundred yards into an isolation room in the cellar of our big barn. Yes, it's the same one where we sequester the death row roosters. I didn't discuss that with her. In fact, when I shut her in there by herself, she immediately perked up, raising her head and folding her wings onto her back, shaking her fluffed feathers neatly back into place, looking around brightly for what she might find to do next. I hardly trusted this miracle recovery. But an hour later, when I came back to check on her, she was still perky and now calling desperately for her friends. Turkey hens hate being alone. I decided I must have worried the whole thing out of thin air. I led her back up to the turkey pen. She walked into the midst of her brethren, heaved a great turkey sigh, and drooped back down again, head hunched, wings dragging the ground. Okay, I wasn't imagining it. She really had something. I shepherded her back out and down to the barn again, and once again watched in astonishment as she lifted her head brightly and began to walk around looking for something to eat. I stared at her. "Are you gold bricking?" I demanded. It was a sunny Saturday, our first little sneak preview of spring. Stephen was down in the new orchard working on the fence. I decided my poultry patient could use a mental health day. I let her out of the barn, and we walked together down the road toward the orchard. She could get some sunshine and fresh greens, and I'd see if Stephen needed help with the fence. He saw us coming down the lane together and laughed. Turkey herders are not a respected class of people. "She needs some fresh pasture," I said defensively. "She has some kind of droopy sickness." "She looks fine," he said, which was maddeningly true, and went back to the fence that's meant to discourage deer from eating our young pear orchard. For a few minutes, I watched Ms. Turkey happily foraging among the trees, pecking at seed heads, alerting to any small movement of insects among the clumps of grass. She seemed as healthy as the day she was born. Some of our trees, on the other hand, showed signs of deer damage. I inspected them closely and considered going back up to the shed to get the lop shears. This winter day would be a good time for pruning the fruit trees. Stephen yelled, "Hey, knock it off!" I looked up to see he wasn't talking to me. My charge had wandered over to him, approaching from behind and reaching up with her beak to give his jacket a good tug, issuing a turkey mandative I would translate as, "Hey, look at me!" He nudged her away, but she persisted. After several more tugs, he turned to face her directly, planted his feet, and made a very manly sort of huff. On that cue, she coyly turned her tail toward him, jutted her neck, and dropped her wings to the ground. Oh my goodness! It wasn't, "Hey, look at me." It was, "Hey, sailor, new in town?" That's what she had. Love sickness. Stephen shot me a look I will not translate here. "Stop that," I yelled. "He is so not your type." I ran to interrupt her in case she meant to move their relationship to the next level. Poor thing, how would she know? She was raised by humans, with no opportunity to imprint on adult turkeys of either gender or observe proper turkey relations. As far as she knew, I was her mother. It's only logical that the person I married would strike her as a good catch. As quickly as possible, I ushered her back to the turkey pen, putting the kibosh on her plot to win away my husband. But now what? We'd kept 2 males and 6 females for breeding purposes, with no real logic behind this number, beyond a hope that we'd still have enough in case we lost any birds over the winter. Were they now all about to come into season? Would our 2 toms suddenly wake up and start killing each other over this droopy Lolita? And what about the other hens? Who needed to be separated from whom? For how long? Would every hen need her own nest? And if so, what would it look like? I had assumed I'd cross all these bridges when I came to them. I remember harboring exactly this kind of unauthorized confidence before I had my first baby, also, only to look back eventually upon my ignorance and bang my head with the flat of my hand. Now, suddenly, long before I'd ever expected any shenanigans, like parents of turkey teens everywhere, I was caught by surprise. They're too young for this. It's only February. I went indoors to check our farm library for anything I could find about turkey mating behavior. I spent way too much of a beautiful day inside, on the floor, with books stacked all around me. Our poultry husbandry manuals contained a total of nothing about turkey sex. I kept looking, checking indices for various barnyard euphemisms. Nothing. Honestly, our kids' bookshelves had over the years been furnished with more literature in the now-that-you're-growing-up department. You'd think some turkey fundamentalists had been in here burning books. The real problem, of course, was that I was looking for a category of information nobody has needed for decades. The whole birds and bees business has been bred out of turkeys completely, so this complex piece of former animal behavior is now of no concern to anyone. Large-scale turkey hatcheries artificially inseminate their breeding stock. They extract the eggs in a similarly sterile manner and roll them into incubators, where electric warmth and automatic egg-turning devices stand in for motherhood. For the farmers who acquire and raise these hatchlings, the story is even simpler. Fatten them as quickly as possible to slaughter size, then off with their heads. That's it. Poultry handbooks don't go into mating behavior because turkey mating has gone the way of rubberized foundation garments and the drive-in movie. To restore some old-fashioned sex to our farm, I was going to have to scour my sources for some decent sex ed. The internet was no more help. A search for turkey mating scored 670,000 hits, mostly along the lines of this lively dispatch from the Missouri Department of Conservation. More excitement this week. Hunters statewide will find gobblers more responsive to calls. The key to success is sounding like a lovesick turkey hen. I already had a lovesick turkey hen. No need to fake that one. I tried limiting my search to domestic turkeys rather than wild ones. I still got thousands of hits, but not one shred of fact about turkey hokey pokey. I did learn that the bright blue and pink growths on a male turkey's neck are called his caruncle. I learned that the name turkey for this solely North American bird comes from a 400-year-old geographic mistake made by the English. I learned that the French know this bird as a dindon sauvage. That is when I fled from the electronic library, returning to my limited but reassuring paper pages, where I could feel safe from the random onslaught of savage ding-dongs. Finally there, I hit pay dirt. My spouse has a weakness for antique natural history books. His collection of old volumes covers the gamut from Piaget and Audubon to William J. Long, an early 20th century ethologist who attributed animal communications to a telepathic force he called Chumfo. You may gather that I was desperate to be plumbing these depths for help around the farm. But I found a thick tome by E.S.E. Hafez called The Behavior of Domestic Animals. Published mid-20th century, it's probably the most modern entry in Stephen's collection, but for my purposes, that was exactly the right era. Animal science had advanced beyond Chumfo, but had not yet taken the tomfoolery out of the toms. What caught my eye as I flipped through the book was a photograph with this caption, "Female turkey giving the sexual crouch to man." Bingo! The text confirmed my worst suspicions. Turkeys who had imprinted on humans as hatchlings would be prone to batting for the hominid team. But given the chance, the book said, they would likely be open-minded about turkey partners as well. Oh, good. Reading on, I learned that the characteristic droopy crouch is the first sign of sexual receptiveness in girl turkeys. Soon we could expect to see a more extended courtship interaction that would include stomping, boy, deeper crouch, girl, then mounting and much treading around as the male manipulated the female's erogenous area along the sides of the body, followed by the complicated copulatory sequence. Domestic turkeys are promiscuous, I learned, with no inclination toward pair bonding. Egg laying would begin in about 2 weeks. A turkey hen's instinct for sitting on the nest to brood the eggs, if that happened, would be triggered when enough of them had accumulated in the nest. The magic number was somewhere between 12 and 17 eggs. Eggs and nest were all theoretical at this point, but what concerned me most was the broody instinct getting switched on. These mothering instincts have been bred out of turkeys. For confinement birds, the discouragement has been purposeful, and even heirloom breeds are mostly sold by hatcheries that incubate mechanically, so nobody is selecting for good maternal behaviors. Genes get passed on without regard for broody or non-broody behavior. If anything, it's probably a bother to hatchery operations when a mother gets possessive about her young. If I wanted to raise turkeys the natural way, I understood now that I was signing up for a strong possibility of failure, not to mention a deep involvement in the sexual antics of a domestic bird. My interests weren't prurient, though you may come to doubt this later in the chapter. As a biologist and a PTA member, I have a healthy respect for the complex parameters of motherhood. The longer I think about a food industry organized around an animal that cannot reproduce itself without technical assistance, the more I mistrust it. Poultry, a significant part of the modern diet, is emblematic of the whole dirty deal. Having no self-sustaining bloodlines to back up the industry is like having no gold standard to underpin paper currency. Maintaining a naturally breeding poultry flock is a rebellion, at the most basic level, against the wholly artificial nature of how foods are produced. I was the rebel. That was my cause. I had more than just sentimental reasons for wanting to see my turkey hens brood and hatch their babies, however unlikely that might be. I plowed on through my antique reference for more details on nesting and brooding, and what I might do to be a helpful midwife other than boiling water or putting a knife under the bed. My new turkey sex manual got better and better. "Male turkeys," I read, and this is all a quote, "can be forced to broodiness by first being made drowsy, e.g. by an ample dose of brandy, and then being put on a nest with eggs. After recovery from the hangover, broodiness is established. This method was used extensively by farmers in Europe before incubators were available." End quote. I don't think of myself as the type to ply turkey menfolk with brandy and hoodwink them into fatherhood, but a girl needs to know her options. 6 quarts of spaghetti sauce, 4 jars of dried tomatoes, 4 onions, 1 head of garlic at the end of a long, skinny, empty braid, and weeks to go. January is widely held to be the bugbear of local food, but the hungriest month is March if you plan to see this thing through. Your stores are dwindling. Your potatoes are sending pale feelers out into the void. But for most of us, there is nothing new under the sun of muddy March, however it might intend to go out like a lamb. A few spring wildflowers, maybe, but no real eats. Our family was getting down to the bottom of our barrel, which was a good thing for the chest freezer. I know people who layer stuff in there year after year, leaving it to future archaeologists, I gather, to read the good and bad green bean years like tree rings. I've taken microbiology, and honestly, ick. I'm pretty fanatical about emptying the freezer completely before starting over. A quick inventory found our frozen beans long gone, but we still had sliced apples, corn, one whole turkey, and some smoked eggplant from last fall. Also plenty of zucchini, quelle surprise. We would not be the Crayola family then, but the one that survived on zucchini pie. Pretty cushy, as harrowing adventures go. Maybe March doesn't get such a bad rap because it doesn't feel hungry. If it's not the end of winter, you can see it from here. Lily and I were now starting our vegetable and flower seeds indoors, puttering in earnest under the fluorescent lights of our homemade seedling shelves. She had given up all hope of further snow days. And one fine afternoon she bounced off the bus with the news that the fourth graders were going to study gardening at school. For a kid like Lily, this was an unbelievable turn of events. Now, children, we are going to begin a unit on recess. It wasn't just the fourth graders, as it turned out. The whole school was that lucky, along with three other elementary schools in our county. School garden programs have lately begun showing up in schools from the trendsetting Bay Area to working-class Durham, North Carolina. Alice Waters founded the Berkeley programs, developing a curriculum that teaches kids, alongside their math and reading, how to plant gardens, prepare their own school lunches, and sit down to eat them together in a civil manner. She has provided inspiration nationwide for getting fresh-grown food into cafeterias. But most of the garden learning programs scattered through our country's schools have been created independently, as ours was. A local nonprofit helps support it. The school system has been cooperative, but our Learning Landscapes curriculum is the dream and full-time project of a green-thumbed angel named Denny. She helps the kindergartners grow popcorn and plant a rainbow of flowers to learn their colors. Second graders make a special garden for hummingbirds, bees, and butterflies while learning about pollination. Third graders grow a pizza garden that covers the plant kingdom. Lily's class was starting seeds they planned to set out in a colonial herb garden, giving some life to their Virginia history lessons. Each grade's program is tied to concrete objectives the kids must know in order to pass their state-mandated testing. Virtually everyone I know in the school system feels oppressed by these testing regimes hanging over everything. Teachers sense them as huge black clouds on the horizon of April. For the kids, it's more like a permanent threat of air attack. In our state, no kidding, they are called Standards of Learning, or SOLs. I don't think anyone intended the joke. But Learning Landscapes works because it gets kids outdoors studying for tests while believing they are just playing in dirt. Denny knows how to get the approval of a school board, but she has a larger game plan for these kids than just passing the next exam. She told me one of the key things gardens can teach students is respect for themselves, for others, and the environment. It helps future generations gain an understanding of our food system, our forests, our water and air, and how these things are all connected. From a biological perspective, the ultimate act of failure is to raise helpless kids. Not a parent I know who's worth the title wants to do that. But our operating system values advanced placement comparative politics, for example, way, way ahead of knowing how to make your own lunch. Kids who can explain how supernovas are formed may not be allowed to get dirty in playgroup, and many teenagers who could construct and manage a website would starve if left alone on a working food farm. That's hardly their fault. We all may have some hungry months ahead of us, even hungry years, when a warmed-up globe changes the rules of a game we smugly thought we'd already aced. We might live to regret some of our SOL priorities. But the alumni of at least one Appalachian County's elementary schools will know how to grow their own pizzas, and I'm proud of them. If I could fit that on a bumper sticker, I would.
Legislating Local by Stephen Hoppe. The epidemic of childhood obesity in the United States has incited parents, communities, and even legislators to improve kids' nutrition in one place they invariably eat: schools. Junk foods have been legally banned from many lunchrooms and school vending machines. But what will our nation's youth eat instead? Fresh local produce, as if. Dude, it's going down. In 2004, in a National School Lunch Act amendment, Congress authorized a seed grant for the Farm to Cafeteria program, promoting school garden projects and acquisition of local foods from small farms. The Local Produce Business Unit of the Department of Defense actually procures produce. Benefits of these programs, above and beyond the food, include agricultural education through gardening, farm visits, presentations by local farmers, and modest economic gains for the community. More than one-third of our states now have active farm-to-school programs. Farm-to-college alliances are also growing. The USDA Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, or WIC, has a farmers market nutrition program for purchasing local food. It provides coupons good for fresh produce purchased from farms, farmers markets, and roadside stands. In 2006, some $20 million in government funds provided these benefits to more than 2.5 million people. In a strong legislative move, Woodbury County, Iowa, mandated in 2006 that the county, subject to availability, quote, shall purchase locally produced organic food when a department of Woodbury County serves food in the usual course of business. Even the prisons are serving local food in a county that truly recognizes the value of community support. For more information, visit foodsecurity.org and farmtoschool.org.
My pupils in the turkey coop were not such quick studies. The first hen who'd come into season was getting no action from either of the two males, whom we had lately been calling Big Tom and Bad Tom. These guys had been fanning their tails in urgent mating display since last summer, more or less constantly, but they directed the brunt of their show-off efforts toward me, each other, or any sexy thing I might leave sitting around, such as a watering can. They really tried hard with the watering can. Lolita kept plopping herself down where they'd have to trip over her, but they only had eyes for some shiny little item. She sulked, and I didn't blame her. Who hasn't been there? I determined to set a more romantic scene, which meant escorting Lolita and one of the Toms into their own honeymoon suite, a small private room inside the main barn, and removing any watering cans from his line of sight. She practically had to connect the dots for him. No bras to unhook, heaven be praised. But finally, he started to get the picture. She crouched. He approached, and finally stopped quivering his tail feathers to impress her. After all these many months, it took him a couple of beats to shift gears from, get the babe, to, oh, yes! Inch by inch, he walked up onto her back. Then he turned around in circles several times, slowly, like the minute hand of a clock, before appearing to decide on the correct orientation. I was ready to hear the case for artificial insemination, but it looked like now he was giving it a go. The final important event after all this awkward foreplay is what bird scientists call the cloacal kiss. A male bird doesn't have anything you would call a member, or whatever you call it at your house. He just has an orifice, or cloaca, more or less the same equipment as the female, except that semen is ejected from his, and eggs come out of hers later on. Those eggs will be fertile only if the two orifices have previously made the prescribed kind of well-timed contact. I watched, I don't mind saying. Come on, wouldn't you? Possibly you would not have stooped quite as low as I did for the better view, but geez, we don't get cable out here. And this truly was an extraordinary event, something that's nearly gone from our living world. For 99.9% of domestic turkeys, life begins in the syringe and remains sexless to the end. Few people alive have witnessed what I was about to see. Cloacal kiss is exactly the right name for it. The male really has to extend that orifice, like puckering up for a big smooch. Try to picture this, though. He's standing on her back, tromping steadily and clutching his lady so as not to fall off. The full complement of her long tail feather fan lies between his equipment and hers. The pucker has to be heroic to get around all that. Robert Browning said it perfectly. Ah, but a man's reach should exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for? Paradise arrives when a fellow has kneaded his lady's erogenous wing zones for a long, long time with his feet, until she finally decides her suitor has worked himself up to the necessary fervor. Without warning, quick as an eye blink, she flips up her tail feathers and reaches upward to meet him. Oh my gosh, I gasped to see it. It was an air kiss. They really did miss. Mwah! Like a pair of divas on stage who don't want to must their lipstick. Not Britney and Madonna. But rare is the perfect first attempt, I know as well as the next person who has ever been young. She wandered off, slightly dazed, to a corner of the dark little room. He stared after her, his feathers all slack for once in his life, divining that this was not the time to put on a tail-shaking show. He knit his caruncled brow and surely would have quoted Shakespeare if he'd had it in him. Trip no further, pretty sweeting, journey's end in lover's meeting. She pecked listlessly at some grain on the dirt floor. Probably she'd been hoping for better room service. What's to come is still unsure. In delay there lies no plenty. Then come kiss me, sweet and twenty. Youth's a stuff will not endure. I left them there, to love again on the morrow, or maybe in 15 minutes. After all, they were kids. Animal behaviorists refer to a mating phenomenon called the Coolidge effect, a term deriving from an apocryphal story about the president and first lady. On an official visit to a government farm in Kentucky, they are said to have been impressed by a very industrious rooster. Mrs. Coolidge asked her guide how often the cockerel could be expected to perform his duty, and was informed, dozens of times a day. "Please tell that to the president," she said. The president, upon a moment's reflection, asked, "Was this with the same hen each time?" "Oh, no, Mr. President," the guide replied, "a different one each time." The president smiled. "Tell that to Mrs. Coolidge." 2 weeks after our Lolita came down with lovesickness, the rest of the hens followed. Now we recognized the symptoms. Scientific as always in our barnyard, we applied the Coolidge effect, separating either Big Tom or Bad Tom with a new hen each day in the romantic barn room, while the other Tom chased the rest of the girls around the pasture. We had to keep the boys apart from one another, not so much because they fought, though they did, but because any time one of them managed to mount a hen, the other would charge like a bowling ball down the lane and topple the lovers most ungracefully, kapow. Nothing good was going to come of that. But after the February of love dawned over our barnyard, it was followed by the March of the Turkey Eggs. We hoped this was good, although the first attempts looked like just one more wreck along the love train track. It's normal for a young bird to need a few tries to get her oviduct work in order, but to be honest, I didn't even recognize the first one as an egg. I went into the turkey coop to refill the grain bin and almost stepped on a weird thing on the floor. I stooped down to poke at it, a pale bag of fluid, soft to the touch, teardrop-shaped, with a rubbery white corkscrew at the pointy end. A small visitor from another planet? I tentatively decided it was an egg, but did not uncork the champagne. Soon, real eggs followed, larger and more pointed than chickens' eggs, light brown with a cast of reddish freckles. I was thrilled with the first few. Then, suddenly, they were everywhere, dropped coyly on the floor like hankies, hither and yon about the coop, outside in the caged run, and even splat on the grass of the pasture. When the urge struck these girls, they delivered, like the unfortunate mothers one hears about having their babies in restaurant foyers and taxicabs. I had fashioned what I thought to be a respectable turkey nest on the floor in one corner of the coop, but no one was using it. Clearly, it didn't look right to them, maybe not cozy enough. We built a big wooden box with open sides to set over the nest for protection. The turkeys roosted at night on high rafters inside their coop and always flew around rambunctiously before going to bed. Bourbon reds have wings and are not afraid to use them. Maybe the nest on the floor would have more appeal, I reasoned, if I made it safe from aerial assault. This struck some chord in the turkey psyche, but not the right one. The hens immediately began laying eggs on top of the wooden platform, about 3 feet off the ground. My reference book insisted turkeys will only use floor nests. My turkeys hadn't heard about that. Within days, I had no more eggs on the floor, but nearly 24 in a precarious clutch on a plywood platform where they could easily roll off and smash. I cut down the sides of a big cardboard box to make a shallow tray, filled it with straw and leaves, and put the eggs in there. Finally, I'd guessed right. The sight of this cozy pile of eggs in a computer monitor shipping carton was just what it took to throw the hormonal switch. One by one, the turkey hens began sitting on the nest, after a fashion. They would lay an egg, sit just a few minutes longer, and leave. Soon I had more than 30 eggs in this platform nest, and no mother worth a corsage, to say the least. Most of them did try, a little. As time passed and the pile grew to ridiculous proportions, they seemed to feel some dim sense of obligation. A hen would sit on the eggs for an hour. Then she'd hop up, wander away, and go get a snack. Or she would land on the nest, lay one egg, tromp around on the pile until she'd broken two, then eat them and go bye-bye. Often two hens would sit on the eggs together, amiable for a while, until they'd begin to tussle with one another. Sometimes this would escalate until they were fanning their tail feathers and displaying at one another exactly the way the males do. Then, suddenly, they'd quit and go do lunch together. I became hopeful when one hen, not always the same one, would stay on the eggs until late morning, when I usually let all the turkeys out into the pasture. She would stay behind as the sisters nattered out the door, but always after a while she would decide she'd had all she could take of that and scream to be let out with her friends for the rest of the day. With all due respect for very young mothers who are devoted to their children, I began to think of my hens as teen moms of the more stereotypical kind. "I'm not ready to be tied down," was the general mindset. Free bird was the anthem. Nobody was worrying over this growing pile of eggs except me. I fretted as they strolled away, scolding each slacker mother. You turkey! Dindon sauvage, pardon my French. You've made your nest, now sit on it. My nagging had the predictable effect, that is, none. I felt bereft. Most nights were still below freezing. What could be more pitiful than a huge nest of beautiful eggs sitting out in the cold? Potentially viable, valuable eggs left to die. That many heirloom turkey eggs, purchased mail order for incubation, would cost about $300, and that is nothing compared with the real products of awkward, earnest turkey love. But what was I supposed to do, sit on them myself? That, essentially, is what the professionals do. Our feed store carried several models of incubators, which I'd scrutinized more than once. This would be the simple answer. Put the eggs in an electric incubator, watch them hatch, and raise baby turkeys myself one more time. Turkeys that would once again grow up wanting to mate with something like me. Is it possible to rear eggs in an incubator and slip them under a female adult after they've hatched? Easy answer. Yes, and she will kill them. Possibly eat them, as horrifying as that sounds. Motherhood is the largest work of most lives, and natural selection cannot favor a huge investment of energy in genes that are not one's own. It's straightforward math. The next generation will contain zero young from individuals whose genes let them make that choice. In animals other than humans, adoption exists only in rare and mostly accidental circumstances. In the case of turkeys, the mother's brain is programmed to memorize the sound of her chicks peeping the moment they hatch. This communication cements her bond with her young, causing her to protect them intensely during their vulnerable early weeks, holding her wings out and crouching to keep the kids hidden under something like a feathery hoop skirt, day and night, while they make brief forays out into the world, learning to find their own food. Early 20th century experiments, awful ones to contemplate, showed that deafened mother turkeys were unable to get the all-important signal from their young. These mothers destroyed their own chicks, even after sitting on the eggs faithfully for weeks. My hens seemed to have good ears, but the faithful sitting was not their long suit. Still, I didn't buy an incubator. I wanted turkey chicks raised by turkey mothers, creatures that would literally know how to be true to their own kind. The project allows no shortcuts. If we could just get a first generation out of one of these mothers, the next ones would have both better genes and better rearing. The alternative possibility, a lot of botched hatchlings, made me sad. The temptation is to save the individual that pulls on your heartstrings, even at the cost of the breed. When I'd signed on to the small club of heritage animal breeders, part of the deal was refraining from this kind of sentimentality. Poor mothering instincts, runts, and genetic weaklings all have to be culled. In a human-centric world that increasingly, and wisely in my opinion, defines all humans as intrinsically equal, it's hard not to color this thinking outside of the lines. But the rules for healthy domestic animal populations are entirely unlike those we apply to ourselves. I came up against this when trying to explain to my nephew why we can't let the white rooster mate with the brown hens. I decided to drop the subject for a few years, but I'll bring it up again if he asks, because it's important information. Respect takes different forms for different species. The apple tree gains strength from strict breeding and regular pruning. So does the herd. Our purpose for keeping heritage animals is food system security, but also something else that is less self-serving. The dignity of each breed's true and specific nature. A Gloucester Old Spots hog in the pasture, descended from her own ancient line, making choices minute by minute about rooting for grubs and nursing her young, contains in her life a sensate and intelligent pigness. It's a state of animal grace that never even touches the sausages on hooves in an industrial pig lot. One can only hope they've lost any sense of the porcine dignities stolen from them. If it seems a stretch to use the word dignity in the same sentence with pig, or especially turkey, that really proves my point. It was never their plan to let stupid white eunuchs take over. It was ours. And now the genuine self-propagating turkeys with astute mothering instincts are all but lost from the world. My Bourbon Reds and I had come through hard times together, and I was still rooting for them. They had grown up handsome and strong, disease-free, good meat producers, efficient pasture foragers. I found myself deeply invested in the next step. I wanted them to make it to the next generation on their own. Natural childbirth or bust. All my eggs were in one basket now. If they dropped it, we'd have pumpkin soup next Thanksgiving.
Taking Local on the Road by Camille. I have a confession to make. 5 months into my family's year of devoted local eating, I moved out. Not because the hours of canning tomatoes in early August drove me insane, or because I was overcome by insatiable cravings for tropical fruit. I just went to college. It was a challenging life, getting through chemistry and calculus while adjusting to a whole new place, and the limited dining options I had as a student living on campus didn't help. I suppose I could have holed up a personal vegetable patch on the quad or filled my dorm room with potted tomato and zucchini plants. But then people would really have made fun of me for being from Appalachia. Instead, I ate lettuce and cucumbers in January, just like all the other kids. Living away from home, talking with my family over the phone, gave me some perspective. Not having fresh produce at my disposal made me realize how good it is. I also noticed that how I think about food is pretty unusual among my peers. When I peruse the salad bar at my dining hall most evenings, grimly surveying the mealy, pinkish tomatoes and paper-like iceberg lettuce, I could pick out what probably came from South America or New Zealand. I always kept this information to myself, because who really cares when there are basketball games and frat parties to talk about? But I couldn't help noticing it. I suppose my generation is farther removed from food production than any other, just one more step down the path of the American food industry. More than our parents, we rely on foods that come out of shiny wrappers instead of peels or skins. It still surprises a girl like me, who actually lives on a real farm with real animals and stuff growing out of the ground, that so many young adults couldn't guess where their food comes from, or when it's in season where they live. It's not that my rising generation is unintelligent or unworldly. My classmates are some of the smartest, most cultured people I know. But information about food and farming is not very available. Most of the people I know have never seen a working farm or had any reason to do so. Living among people my age from various cities across the United States made me realize I actually know a lot about food production, and I don't take that for granted. I also won't forget to appreciate how much better local food tastes. Next to getting a good night's sleep on a comfortable mattress, cooking good food became my main motivation for coming home from school to visit. Of course, seeing my family was nice, but priorities are priorities, right? It was great after weeks of dorm life to eat eggs with deep golden yolks and greens that still had their flavor and crunch. I loved being able to look at a table full of food and know where every vegetable was grown, where the meat lived when it was still a breathing animal. During my first year of college, I found two campus eateries that use organic, locally grown produce in their meals and one that consistently uses free-range meat. For the most part, these vendors did not widely advertise the fact that they were participating in the local food economy. I only found out because I cared and then tried to buy most of my food from those places. My generation, I know, has the reputation of sticking iPods in our ears and declining to care about what might happen in 10 years or even next week. We can't yet afford hybrid vehicles or solar homes, but we do care about a lot of things, including what we eat. Food is something real. Living on the land that has grown my food gives me a sense of security I'm lucky to have. Feeling safe isn't so easy for people my age, who face odious threats like global warming, overpopulation, and chemical warfare in our future. But even as the world runs out of fuel and the ice caps melt, I will know the real sources of my sustenance. My college education may or may not land me a good job down the road, but my farm education will serve me. The choices I make now about my food will influence the rest of my life. If a lot of us felt this way and started thinking carefully about our consumption habits just one meal at a time, we could affect the future of our planet. No matter how grave the predictions I hear about the future, for my peers and me, that's a fact that gives me hope.
Chapter 20. Time Begins. Years ago, when Lily was not quite 4, we were spending one of those perfect mother-daughter mornings in the flower garden. I planted pansies while she helped by picking up the bugs for closer looks and not eating them at all. 3 is a great age. She was asking a lot of questions about creature life, I remember, because that was the day she first worked up to the big question. I don't mean sex, that's easy. She wanted to know where everything comes from. Beetles, plants, us. How did dinosaurs get on the earth, and why did they go away, was her reasonable starting point. How lovely it might be to invoke for my child, in just one or two quotes, the inexplicable mystery. But I went to graduate school in evolutionary biology, which kind of obligates me to go into the details. Lily and I talked about the millions and millions of years, the seaweeds and jellyfish and rabbits. I explained how most creatures have many children, some have thousands, with lots of small differences between them. These specialties, things like quick hiding or slow, picky eating or just shoveling everything in, can make a difference in whether the baby lives to be a grown-up. The ones that survive will have children more like themselves. And so on. The group slowly changes. I've always thought of this as a fine creation story, a sort of quantifiable miracle, and was pleased to think I'd rendered such a complex subject comprehensible to a toddler. She sat among the flowers, pondering it. At length she asked, "Mama, did you get born, or are you one of the ones that evolved from the tree primates?" I'm not 8 million years old, but I am old enough to know I should never, ever trust I've explained anything perfectly. Some part of the audience will always remain at large, confused or plain unconvinced. As I wind up this account, I'm weighing that. Is it possible to explain the year we had? I can tell you we came to think of ourselves in the best way as a family of animals living in our habitat. Does that reveal the meaning of our passage? Does it explain how we're different now, even though we look the same? We are made of different stuff, with new connections to our place. We have a new relationship with the weather. So what, and who cares? All stories, they say, begin in one of two ways. A stranger came to town, or else I set out upon a journey. The rest is all just metaphor and simile. Your high school English teacher was right. In Moby Dick, you'll know, if you were half awake, the whale was not just an aquatic mammal. In our case, the heirloom turkeys are not just large birds, but symbols of a precarious hold on a vanishing honesty. The chickens are secondary protagonists. The tomatoes are allegorical. The zucchini may be just zucchini. We set out upon a journey. It seemed so ordinary on the face of things, to try to do what nearly all people used to do without a second thought. But the trip surprised us many times, because of all the ways a landscape can enter one's physical being. Like most of the other top-heavy hominids walking around in shoes, failing to notice the forest for the mashed trees reincarnated as our newspapers and such, I'd nearly forgotten the truest of all truths. We are what we eat. As our edible calendar approached its arbitrary conclusion, we were more than normally conscious of how everything starts over in the springtime. All the milestones that had nudged us toward the start of our locavore year began to wink at us again. Our seedlings came up indoors. The mud ice melted, and the spice bushes in the lane covered themselves with tiny yellow pom-poms of flower. The tranquils bloomed. On April 3rd, the secretive asparagus began to nose up from its bed. What were we doing when the day finally came? Standing by our empty chest freezer at midnight, gnawing our last frozen brick of sliced squash, watching the clock tick down the seconds till we could run out and buy moon pies? No. I'm sorry, but the truth is so undramatic, I can't even find the day in my journal. The best I can do is recall a moment when I understood I had kept some promise to myself, having to do with learning to see the world differently. It was a day in early April when three little trees in our yard were covered with bloom, dark pink peach blossoms, pale pink plum, and white pear, filling the space like a Japanese watercolor. The air smelled spicy. The brown pasture had turned brilliant green. From where I stood on the front porch, I could see my white-winged turkeys moving slowly through that emerald sea, nibbling as they went. I pictured how it would be in another month when the grass shot up knee-deep. I was struck, then, with a vivid fantasy of my family being in the turkey's place, imagining what a thrill it would be to wander chest-deep in one's dinner as an ordinary routine. I mean to say, I pictured us wading through piles of salad greens, breast-stroking into things like tomatoes, basil, and mozzarella. I snapped out of it, recognizing this was not a very normal daydream. This was along the lines my astute children would diagnose as wackadoo. I took myself to be a woman changed by experience. But I'd noticed the kids had changed too. One day at the farmer's market, a vendor had warned us there might be some earworms in the corn because it was unsprayed. He pointed out a big one wriggling in the silks of one of the ears in our bag and reached in to pluck it off. Lily politely held out her hand. That was our worm. We'd paid for it. She would take that protein to her chickens, and in time it would be eggs. Camille used similar logic to console me after my turkeys raided the garden and took some of the nicest tomatoes. "Mom," she said, "you'll eat them eventually." And I did. It wasn't just our family, either, that had changed in a year. Food was now very much a subject of public conversation, not recipes, but issues. When we'd first dreamed up our project, we'd expected our hardest task would be to explain in the most basic terms what we were doing and why on earth we'd bother. Now our local newspaper and national ones frequently had local food feature stories on the same day. Every state had it going on, including Arizona, the food scene we feared we had left for dead. Alaska was experiencing a farmer's market boom, with the Alaska Grown logo showing up on cloth shopping bags all over Anchorage. Todd Murphy's Farmer's Diner, in order to accommodate more diners, had relocated south to Keechee Village, Vermont, near Hanover, New Hampshire. Other like-minded eateries now lay in the path of many a road trip. Hundreds of people were signing up online and reporting on their locavore month experiences. We had undertaken a life change partly as a reaction against living in a snappily named diet culture. Now this lifestyle had its own snappy diet name, the 100-mile diet challenge. What a shock. We were trendy. As further proof that the movement had gained significance, local eating now had some official opposition. The standard criticisms of local food as quixotic and elitist seemed to get louder as more and more of us found it affordable and utterly doable. The Christian Science Monitor even ran a story on how so much local focus could breed unhealthy provincialism. John Clark, a development specialist for Where Else, the World Bank, argued that, and this is his quote, "What are sweatshop jobs for us may be a dream job for someone else," end quote, presumably meaning those folks who earn a few dreamy bucks a day from Dole, Kraft, Unilever, or Archer Daniel Midland's. He said, "But all that goes out the window if we only buy local." He expressed concern that local food bias would lead to energy waste as rabidly provincial consumers drove farmers in icy climes to grow bananas in hothouses. That's some creative disapproval, all right. A sure sign the local food movement was getting worrisome to food industrialists who had heretofore controlled consumer choices so handily, even when they damaged our kids' health and our neighborhoods. Shoppers were starting to show some backbone, clearly shifting certain preferences about what foods they purchased and from where. An estimated 3% of the national supply of fresh produce had moved directly from farmers to customers that year. The "why bother" part of the equation was also becoming obvious to more people. Global climate change had gone in 1 year from unmentionable to cover story. The end of the oil economy was now being discussed by some politicians and many economists, not just tree huggers and Idaho survivalists. We were starting to get it. But it's also true what the strategists say about hearts and minds. You have to win them both. We will change our ways significantly as a nation, not when some laws tell us we have to. Remember Prohibition? But when we want to. During my family's year of conscious food choices, the most important things we've learned were all about that, the wanting to. Our fretful minds had started us on a project of abstinence from industrial food, but we finished it with our hearts. We were not counting down the days until the end, because we didn't want to go back. A few days after my momentary chest-deep-in-food fantasy, we had dinner with our friends Sylvain and Cynthia. Sylvain grew up in the Loire Valley, where local food is edible patriotism, and I sense